Allegedly, Albert Einstein said, when the last honeybee disappears, the human race has 4 more years to survive. Well, whether he really said that or not is highly debated, but the sentiment may have some validity. Honeybee populations all over the world are on the decline. Now, some people fear them, and some are allergic to their sting. But honeybees give us honey to flavor our palate, bee pollen to fight allergies, they pollinate our trees and our flowers, and according to the USDA, the bee pollination is responsible for a $15 billion crop value. In essence, they are man's best friend, and man may just be the honeybee's best friend. With the rapid spread of the varroa mite, also known as the vampire mite, and the strange occurrence of bee disappearance, beekeepers are rapidly becoming the primary hosts to billions of buzzing guests. Hello, I'm Tika Ballas, your host this week for Hometown Alaska. Today, my guests and I will discuss beekeeping in the Great Land, how to become a beekeeper, how to maintain a hive, and what being a bee is all about. Please call in and share your comments and questions with us this afternoon. Today in the studio, we have Mike Radford of Alaska Bee Products and Supplies. He's been beekeeping for 4 years here in Anchorage, and he's a member of the South Central Alaska Beekeepers Association. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon.
And on the phone with us from Palmer, we have Mark Couch. He's the owner of Alaska Forge, a blacksmithing company, and he has been keeping for about 18 years now in Alaska. Hello, Mark. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
Again, you're listening to Hometown Alaska. Many of our listeners may have questions about bees, how to hinder them, and how to harbor them. And perhaps you just have questions about bees and their curious ways. Please call in and share your questions and comments with us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can shoot us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org. Now, gentlemen, neither of you, as far as I can tell, started out as entomologists. But why don't you tell me a little bit about how you did become a beekeeper? Mike, you've been beekeeping for 4 years, right?
That's correct.
And exactly how did you fall into this?
Oh, I was down in West Virginia a few years back visiting my grandmother, and there was a swarm in a holly tree. So we called up a beekeeper, a hardware store, and he knew where a beekeeper was that would come and get the swarm. And he came out in the evening and says, I'll be back at 6 in the morning. And that's the last, you know, he came in and got the bees. We watched them and learned a lot there. And years later, when I've been up here for about 37 years. About 4 years ago, friends of mine were beekeeping there in the Spinard area. And I got enough time, which I found out takes a little bit more time than I thought it did, to do some beekeeping properly. I got into it. And then, like Mark there, up there in Palmer area, I started out with 2 hives, and the next year I went to 10, you know, so I figured if you wanted to learn about bees and beekeeping, you could have 1 hive and learn slow, or you could have 10 hives and learn 10 times faster, so.
Would you say it was like a hobby then?
Yeah, it's a hobby. On this right now, it's a hobby. You could be considered a hobby beekeeper, yeah.
And how about you, Mark? Do you consider yours, after 18 years, a hobby still?
Well, when I went into it, the plan was to have a method of getting out of what I was doing and make it into a business. And at this point, it goes on my tax forms, but it's still not a viable business in that it makes enough to displace much else.
Well, let's go into like what this business is. First of all, people who want to go into beekeeping, they have to get themselves a hive or a bee box. And it doesn't look anything like what most people find under their awnings or in their trees, right? So, Mark, can you explain for our listeners what a bee box kind of looks like?
Most of the hives in the U.S. are Langstroth hives. It's a box that's about 16 inches wide and about 20 inches long. And about 9.5 inches tall. And inside that, there'll be some wooden frames that hold the combs.
And the combs are where the honey is made?
The combs, they either produce brood, or they store pollen, or they store honey in them.
Well, speaking of brood, from everything I read, and what most people don't realize is that there's not just one type of bee. There's many types of bees. And when they're honeybee, there's all kinds of honeybees, in a sense, within a hive. Four types predominantly are the queen, but there's also other names for all of these. Queen, drones, or worker bees, larva, brood, nurse bees, foragers. Mike, can you describe exactly what those four are?
Well, you have the queen bee, and she's responsible for laying the eggs and giving direction to the hive. The nurse bees take care of the queen. They feed her and take care of her waste products. They clean her, and you'll see them around the queen all the time. And then you have the worker bees, which are a lot of the other bees in the hive. They take care of building the comb, cleaning the hive. It's amazing that they're so hygienic. And you can tell if you have a hygienic hive or a non, that's ingrained in their DNA, that some hives will typically be cleaner than others, but most of them are all, it's built into their DNA to clean the hive and keep it good for the queen to lay in. Each cell that she lays an egg in has to be up to her standards, and if it isn't, she won't lay an egg in it. So you have that going on. And then the foragers, the worker bees, Mark can correct me if I'm wrong, they go out, they last for about 2 weeks or so out in the wild, coming back and forth with nectar and pollen and water for the hive, and they literally just wear themselves out. They wear their wings out, and they die. They work themselves to death, and that's basically the life cycle. They go from being born or laid as a little egg, and then the pupa, and then they transform into a bee, and they come out, and they take their different roles in the hive, and sooner or later they go out as a forager and bring back food.
Now, I read something written back in the 1930s, so I don't know if this is still correct information, but is it true that those are all female?
The girls, yeah.
They're the girls. They work till they die.
Yeah.
So how many bees can you normally get to a hive?
Oh, when you first, up here in Alaska, what a lot of people bring packages in, it was 4-pound packages, around 15,000 bees. I bring in 5-pound packages, and it's anywhere from about 22,500 to 25,000 bees. So that's typically what you start out with. And a queen will lay about, on the average, of 2,000 eggs a day if everything's going just right in the hive, 1,500 to 2,500, they say. So average about 2,000, hopefully. And you want a hive to be up to what they refer to as critical mass by the time the nectar flow comes around end of June, first week of July, and you'd love to have about 60,000 bees in there. So,
oh goodness! And when you say you buy a package, does that include the queen bee?
Oh yes, it does. Yeah.
And how much does it cost for a box and a package?
My bee package with the queen, 5 pounds, is $140.
With the box?
It's a 5-pound package of bees with the queen in the package.
Wow.
But it does not include the hive.
No, it doesn't include.
That's your question.
That's right.
Yeah, and how much does the hive cost?
It varies. If you build them yourself, I've built all mine myself. I sell them for about $350 complete from the bottom board all the way to the top. And that includes all the shipping and the assembly and all the frames inside. So and you can get it cheaper if you were to do it yourself. It's still the hard thing we have is it's wood, it's heavy, and it has to be shipped in. So we take it for the shipping.
And Mark, do you sell these as well?
No.
Do you sell honey?
Some.
So how much honey do you tend to get from a hive?
Normally, I think, and this is low compared to what some people are looking at, but I figure if I'm getting 50 pounds a hive, that's good.
In a summer?
Right.
Wow. And does that differ from yours, Mike?
That's about the same. Some people tell you, you'll get 60 pounds or you'll get 100 pounds, but it depends on the location. And, and timing and getting everything just right. And he's right on. I believe about 50 pounds a hive is probably more realistic.
So, Mark, if you're not selling honey, what are you doing with your bees?
Well, we've been, in the last 3 years, we've been building bees, so that we've been building up, and doing that without bringing in new packages, you take your bees to do it, and so you produce less honey. We're selling honey, but not as much as one would assume from the number of hives I have.
And where you're at, do your bees help pollinate different plants, or are they plants that can pollinate on their own?
Well, we've got apple trees here and a number of different kinds of berries, so they help, but we also have natural pollinators like bumblebees that pollinate, so if the honeybees weren't here, I don't think it would be a big hit.
Mm. And speaking of pollinating, there's different types of pollens, and when a bee collects pollen, a lot of us will try to find pollen to fight our allergies. And I understand that different pollens won't work against different allergies because it's not the same thing you're allergic to. Is that right?
Are you asking me?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Okay. I don't know. I've got some customers that buy honey for their allergies, that claim it helps them with their allergies. And to me, it doesn't totally make sense because most of the honey is produced the second half of the summer, and they're using it against allergies that are showing up right when the birch start blooming. And so I can't argue with that it's working for them, but why I'm not so sure.
Do you have more information on that, Mike?
Well, he's right about on using the honey per se as a allergenic helper. My neighbor across the street also has a couple hives, and she swears that the pollen that I gave her last year, it was just, you know, I don't know, half a jug full. I was collecting some, and you write the dates down on when you collected it. And that, she said, if you take a half a teaspoon of pollen in your cereal or what have you every day that she's been feeding to her son, which has allergies, that it has helped him tremendously this year. But it has to do, like Mark said, with the date that you collected the pollen. But the honey, I don't know how it helps, but there is pollen in the honey. Maybe that's what they're dealing with, but I know that the pollen that I collected, I put the date down on the bag, and so I'll know, you know, they say take it 2 weeks before the bloom of the certain tree that's giving the allergies, you know, and it's supposed to help. So can't argue with them. If it helps, it helps.
Again, this is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing beekeeping in Alaska, how to start and maintain beehives, and perhaps we're discussing as well maybe allergies and how bees and their pollen can assist people with their allergies. Perhaps you've had some help out there. If you have, please give us a call. I encourage you to call at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or you can shoot us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org. And there are a bunch of websites that are useful for beekeepers and those aspiring to be. And a few that we'll probably mention throughout the day or the hour, but also a bunch that we probably won't. And they are posted on our website. Just go to kska.org. Now, there are some myths, of course, about bees and myths about honey. And since I mentioned that I was doing this show, I've been hearing all kinds of funny little details. Ran into some tourists who bought some fireweed honey the other day. And the claim on it was that it wasn't made out of any honey. Have you ever heard of such a thing, Mark?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I personally wouldn't ingest it. It's, I don't know how they make it. It's they take the fireweed flower, they strip it off the stem, and then they boil it. Is that what you've heard, Mark?
Yeah, boil it with sugar.
And you know, my fireweed honey that I can say is fireweed is because the bees are in the fireweed, getting the nectar out of that and putting it in the hive and, you know, making honey, actual real honey out of it. And that's the real good stuff.
Now, I got to try some of your fireweed honey last week, and it was quite different from the average, say, clover honey. It was very clear, almost runny instead of thick. Why is that?
Yeah, it's water clear, they call it. It's just, I would imagine it's the purity of the flower that they're getting it from. Maybe Mark knows.
Mark, do you have any idea?
It's a type of the nectar. Some nectars are going to be water white and some aren't. And likely the clover honey that you got from a store, and because clover has a good reputation, legally it only has to be 51% clover, and so they'll blend it with something else. So the clover honey that you're used to, unless you got it from a keeper that was really had his bees on clover, was probably cut. And because it's a mild flavored honey like the fireweed, cutting it with a little bit of something else makes it both darker and stronger. And how runny it is usually a matter of the water content.
So it seems like a lot of people make claims, like if you go into Nusagaya here in town, they have like 40 different types of honey from different flowers, allegedly. I don't even know if it's true. But as a consumer of honey, is there something that you can be aware of when you're buying honey, whether it's at the market or at a farmer's market? And that was GPE, Mark, sorry.
Well, if you're buying it from at a farmer's market, you know, the thing that you would want to probably find out is whether the beekeeper there actually had the bees that produced it. And, you know, I would recommend that you see if you can get a taste, you know, because not all honeys are going to taste the same.
And does a honey they claim that it's a blueberry honey. Is it going to have the flavor of a blueberry then?
No. Blueberry honey would technically be produced from the flowers of a blueberry plant. But, you know, so if it had the blueberry flavor, it would maybe be some sort of a mixture of, you know, like a syrup or something like the Homestead fireweed honey that you were talking about earlier.
And I just bought honey in the desert because I didn't know any better, probably. They claimed that it was from prickly pear and saguaro, both of which only flower for a very short period, like a week, and then they die for the rest of the year. Is it possible then at all, unless you have a whole lot of saguaros flowering at once, to create a saguaro or prickly pear type of honey?
You're asking whether they could have done that?
Yeah, could they have done that?
Sure, if they had the hives in place and they were there when the rain fell and the plants bloomed, they could get a pretty good honey crop in a week.
Just unleash them right away and they're done.
Well, the bees would be there probably eating on something else, and then when a nectar source became available that was significant, they'd transfer to operating on that flower.
Right. And now, Mike, you sell bees and hives to a lot of people here in South Central, correct?
Yes, I do.
And do you find that a majority of the people that you're selling to are buying them for making honey? Producing?
Yeah, they're getting into the hobby, and of course the benefit, if they do everything right, is they get some honey out of it at the end of the season, and they pass it out to the neighbors and their relatives for Christmas gifts, which is really popular in Alaska, and consume as much as they can themselves. I think the average person in America consumes about a pound of honey a year.
Wow, and that would be just directly from the bottle or through products?
Oh. Yeah.
And I spoke with the Alaska Department of Agriculture the other day, and they said that according to them, there are only 9 people in all of South Central Alaska registered with bees.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that. They're putting a drive out right now to, at our last SABA meeting, the Department of Agriculture was there, one of the representatives, with a form so that they could get everybody registered that has bees, and they were amazed at how many people were in the room. So if they had 9, there was a lot more than 9 beekeepers in that room, and so they were pretty amazed. And, you know, it'll probably half of them will register, you know.
Right.
And it's basically so they can find out if there's a American foul brood or European foul brood comes into the state of Alaska, they can identify or go to these beekeepers, they say, and say, hey, you know, and check your hives and try and ward off any diseases that may come up from the lower 48 in the packages.
So what's your guess on how many people you've sold to in South Central?
Oh, between 200 and 300.
And Mark, for you?
I don't sell packages. So.
No, but how many people do you guesstimate in your area?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I hear about different people bringing in packages, and you know, some of them are bringing in maybe 1,000. Of course, they're not all going to different people. There must be at least 500 beekeepers, probably more.
A whole lot more than 9.
Yeah, there's more than 9. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I've got a beekeeper down in Sitka, 2 in Petersburg. One out at Kalskag. She was in Anchorage. She's a school teacher out there. Wanted to have her hive out at Kalskag so she could show the kids that, hey, there's a world out there. And I have a guy down in Kodiak that has 3 hives. So, you know, they're all over the place. And Fairbanks, Big Delta. Fairbanks is really good because of the warm summers up there.
Now, in your experience, Mike, the people that you sell your hives to, how many of them continue on, and how many of them give up usually after the first year?
I don't really have a record of that. People get frustrated with it. 2 years ago, remember that, Mark? Everybody's bees died, or they didn't get any honey from it because we had a real wet, rainy, you know, cool summer. Last year was great, so everybody's happy this year, hoping that they'll get, you know, the same amount of honey this year as they got last year. But you got to understand, it's farming. You got to do a lot of things just right and take care of your bees to get a good result at the end of the year, and then hope Mother Nature helps out.
Now, it seems at one point in time, sometime back, more like in the 70s and early 80s, there were a lot of publications that stated it was better to just do a hands-off approach to your beehives, let them be. And then it came about that people were contradicting that, stating that you needed to check your bees, especially during the season, almost daily. Do you agree with that, Mike?
I don't do it daily. I do it once a week. And you know when the flows are going to start, the nectar flow, and you know the condition of your hive. But once a week is what I've been taught. I don't know what Mark's doing, but probably about the same.
Yeah, Mark, how do you tend to your bees?
Well, in the spring, I don't need to see them quite that often.
No, yeah, right.
From about now till the middle of July or so, I'll probably be in there once a week so I can be on top of it if they're getting ready to swarm. And then from then until the middle of August, I might only go in once. And then I'll pull the honey about the middle of August, and then I'll start getting them ready for winter.
And speaking of winter, how do you winter your bees?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, last year we put them all indoors. I've done them outdoors before, but moving them indoors, we've got an insulated building and got a fan that comes on a timer to bring in fresh air and a very small heater, but I don't think I need the heater really because bees are generating enough heat that with the insulated building they pretty much keep it warmed up to about 40.
About 40 degrees Fahrenheit?
That's our target, yeah.
And what's your success rate with wintering them then?
If things go halfway decent, about
80%. 80% is pretty good. And Mike, I understand that you don't winter your bees.
No, I haven't done it yet. I plan on doing it this year.
And what's your reasoning that you hadn't done it before?
It's just inexperience probably, and the looking at what people go through to get it a good, 80% is really good, and he's been at it a long time, is very meticulous, and I don't have a warmed up or a building to put him in, which I agree would make tremendous advantage to trying to keep the bees alive. We have a long winter, and it's not the cold that kills them. You know, we have a winter that's 2 months longer than anybody else in the lower 48, So having said that, that's one of the big things I was looking at is, you know, putting all the money into keeping them alive and keeping their stores up and getting them right for winter, as opposed to eradicating them at the end and just buying another package. It was probably a break-even deal. You know, one way, you probably wouldn't spend as much money if you killed them at the end of the season. So, and buy a new package in the beginning of the spring.
Well, this is Hometown Alaska on KSKA. I'm Tika Ballas, and we're talking about beekeeping in Alaska. Stay with us.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the show repeats tonight at 10. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking phone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, you can also find a copy of today's Hometown Alaska online at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
If you've just tuned in, this is Hometown Alaska on KSKA. I'm Tika Ballas, and we're discussing how to start and maintain beehives. If you're a beekeeper and you have some input on how to keep a happy, healthy hive, or if you have any questions pertaining to those bees, I encourage you to call in at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or if you're outside the Anchorage area, dial 888-353-5752. Or email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Now, there's all kinds of funny little facts about bees and lots of things that make them really interesting, even if you don't like honey. People are often very, very afraid of bees. Anything that stings, anything that flies, people get a little eerie of. But how about demything some of this? Do all honeybees sting?
You asking me? Well, in defense of the hive, they do. You know, you go up and kick a hive, somebody's going to come out and greet you with an attitude. The queen has a stinger, but she only takes care. She doesn't use that to protect the hive. It's the worker bees, the guard bees, that protect the hive and the brood within it. So if you see, you know, 30,000 bees swarming up in a tree, and that means flying all around the tree in a clump of bees right there, that's where the queen is usually. They're not interested in protecting the hive anymore. They're looking for a place to set up housekeeping, and they don't have anything to protect, so the swarms typically don't sting. I mean, so that's one of the myths, you know, that you're going to get stung in a swarm. I had a swarm. I picked up two of them last year, and you know, it didn't even get stung. It's just not, doesn't happen unless you like squish one with your thumb while you're doing it or something. So,
probably not a good idea.
No, they get kind of irritated at that.
And Mark, do you find you have a lot of bees? Do you find yourself one of those gentlemen who gets to wear a big beard of bees often?
I don't do that.
I don't either.
Do you get stung?
Yeah, I get stung every once in a while. You know, if something happens frequently enough and the pain isn't all that much, you kind of, it becomes less of an event. But, if, you know, it's like a normal things, you know, when it's something that happens real infrequently and it's not pleasant, then you can be more afraid of it.
Do you find very many beekeepers who have an allergic reaction, like a strong allergic reaction, like anaphylactic shock to bees?
Well, most beekeepers, if they do, stop keeping bees.
Yeah, and the other ones, I had a lady come in, and she was just adamant. She was about 75 years old, adamant about getting bees this year and taking them down to Anchor Point. And I walked her in the garage where I had my bee packages, and I was going to set her up with two, and Of course, there was a couple of hitchhikers, we call them. They were flying around the garage. She ran out of the garage and said, "What's the matter?" She goes, "Oh, I'm deathly allergic to bees." I said, "And what possessed you to go into the beekeeping hobby?" And she says, "I just want to do it." And I said, "Okay, well, here's what you have to do." And she's down there just happy as can be.
Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I live in Chugach, and we have tried a couple years to raise bees, and we just keep getting bare. And so my question is, you know, how do you protect your bees from bears? And we thought about putting our hives, like, up of the garage or something, but I read that may be a problem for the bees, so...
Well, protect them against bears. Most people that I know that are in the rural areas put a electric fence around the beehives, strap them down, strap them together so they don't, when they do, if the bear does get through the electric fence, at least if he tips the hive over, you won't have bees everywhere and hives all over the ground. So that's two ways to help out. And Mark might know some more. 30-06 works pretty good.
Yeah, the other thing you could do is when you strap them together, you could strap them to each other.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
So,
yeah.
So then when he pushes one hive over, pushes several over, and you end up with more bees coming out and making it unpleasant for the bear at the same time. Of course, if you only got one hive, then you won't be able to do that.
Putting them on the garage, I had a couple hives on my garage last year, but you got to remember if there's a way for the bear to get up there, they'll go up a ladder. If you got a ladder in place, he'll go up there. They're curious. They smell the larva. They want to eat something. You know, they're hungry. So you might just have bear problem on your garage after that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily.
You're welcome.
Hello, Ren. Welcome to the show. Hello, Ren?
Yes?
Hi, Ren. Welcome to the show this afternoon.
Hello. I just had a quick question. We don't keep bees, but we know that there's been all the population crashes, so we were wondering if there was any way to encourage bees to kind of be in our area.
Mark, can you answer that?
Well, the population crash has been in relationship to European honeybees, and that's been not, you know, what causes it hasn't really been documented, but it appears to be a pathogen of some sort, or a couple pathogens maybe. So, you know, other than somebody keeping hives, it's not, you know, they don't naturally make it through the winter here normally. So if a swarm escapes somebody's colony, then most of the time they don't have enough time to gather enough stores to set up a hive in a hollow tree and make it through the winter. So,
now, is this in reference to the colony collapse disorder?
Right.
And does anybody understand where these bees go to when they leave? Or,
well, they're not making it back to the hive. And if the workers are out gathering and they don't bring the pollen and the nectar back to the hive for the babies to eat, the brood to eat, then the hive will collapse. There's a couple of items that they're trying to work on. They're doing a tremendous amount of research on it. I was looking that up this afternoon before I came over here, and one of the things that's stressing the bees is the varroa mite and the Nosema. What is it, a fungal virus? And it's in their digestive tract, and when the bees are stressed, they can't do what they need to do, and that... both of those things can be treated either with chemicals or organically. And I choose to treat with organic for the varroa mite, powdered sugar, dusting them with that helps reduce the varroa mite population in the hive. And the Nosema fungus is in their abdomen, and it gives them a dysentery, let's say, and it stresses the bees so they can't put on the weight, and hence with the varroa mite, sucking the blood out of them, they're double stressed. So if you can take care of both of those items as much as you can, and you have a better chance of, you know, warding off some type of colony collapse. And this is what was just in the new SABA newsletter that just came out a few days ago.
Yeah, and the varroa mite is what they refer to as the vampire mite, right?
Yeah.
And this is having a huge effect, as I was reading this afternoon, all over the world. In fact, now people are starting to steal bees from other beekeepers because they keep on losing their colonies, happening in Europe and the lower 48.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
I think there's always been thieves.
there's thieves everywhere, yeah.
Thieves, humans and bears, apparently. Welcome to the show, Sue. How are you doing this afternoon?
Great.
Great. And what would your question be for today?
Well, I had a question. We last year tried to winterize one hive and weren't very successful. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions for trying to do so, or if it's even a feasible idea up in Alaska.
Mark?
Well, let me ask you, what did you do to try and get it ready?
Well, we had it some styrofoam blocks around the outside in which we wrapped some rope around just to try to insulate it somewhat. And then we had a heat mat underneath as
were
well.
Were you feeding it syrup, getting it ready for winter, or were you trying to winter it on honey?
Winter it on honey.
Okay. How much honey did you have in the hive?
Not too much.
Well, they probably starved. Most of the colonies that don't make it up here starve, and a lot of them that don't make it up here starve with a lot of stores in them. They just kind of, you know, the cluster moves up in the winter, and so if it's cold, the cluster gets tighter, and so there's less stores between them and the top. And once they get to the top, they don't move down, and if it's cold, they don't move sideways either, and so they'll starve with a, you know, you got a hive that's got 50 pounds of syrup or honey in it, and they starve there. So,
okay, so it's not necessarily the cold that kills them, it's their starvation.
Right.
Okay,
The thing to do would be to, in my opinion, would be to, you know, maybe leave some honey there, but or leave all the honey if you really wanted to go that route, or else, you know, we feed on a full-size colony. I've been feeding 10 gallons of 2-to-1 sugar syrup in the fall, but I take most of the honey, almost all of it. But I think might be even a little light.
That sounds great. That sounds good. Good suggestion. We'll try it this winter.
Yeah, might add something on the feeding there, Sue. There's another thing that you can do also to help, because the cluster will move around. You don't know where that's going to be in the hive. So another suggestion is to make bee candy. And I think it's 1 cup for a 5-pound bag of sugar. You can get it, Google it on the internet, and it'll tell you, you know, bee candy, how to make it. And you make a 1-inch thick patty that goes over the whole top of the hive that replaces the inner cover. And you lay that on there, put your telescoping cover on there, and when they do move up, like Mark says, they move up throughout the winter, there'll still be something right above them no matter where they are.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think you could do away with the heating mat. They need ventilation. It, like you said, it's not the cold that kills them. It's the moisture in the hive, and the poor little guys just starve to death, and that's a heck of a way to go.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't want that to happen again. So, well, great. That sounds very promising.
You also need to be sure you got pollen in there, because if you don't have pollen in the hive, they won't raise any brood, and they might make it through the winter, but you get through in the spring, and you got this pitiful little cluster that's not even close to package strength.
Yeah,
you got to have enough pollen between where they cluster in the fall and the top that they can raise some brood during the winter.
Exactly, and the pollen patty is a substitute. If you don't have enough pollen or unsure about it, you can put a pollen patties, I mean, quite a bit in there. I've watching a show on YouTube, and they were putting 6 pounds of pollen patty between two boxes of bees, just squishing it down in there, and you know, one top of frames, and then putting the other box down on it, and by January, that was gone, and they were putting it on them again. And, of course, this is in the lower 48, but they were really, like Mark says, putting the pollen patty on them just so that they had that protein in the hive. And The other thing was, let's see, that was about all I could think of. And wrap the hive with tar paper. That's one way of helping it out. But don't forget about the ventilation. So.
Okay.
And the insulation. I wouldn't actively feed something that they didn't store in the middle of the winter. I think that causes dysentery. Uh-huh. But if you right now, if you look in your hive, you'll find some combs that are like solid pollen, probably just to the side of the brood nest. And
okay.
If you take some of those and set them aside, and then you can put those where you want them in the fall when you're getting them ready for winter, and they'll have, you know, the real McCoy for pollen that way.
Oh, okay, okay.
And my question is, does she have to worry about, like, Vero mites through the winter?
It's the overwintered colonies that have to worry about Varroa mites. Not
right.
You know, if you're not wintering, you really don't have anything to worry about. So she needs to think about their population. Whether she needs to do anything about it or not would depend on what kind of a population she's got. And even if she did nothing, they probably wouldn't affect her till next summer or the winter after that, assuming she's starting with a pretty clean package this year.
Oh, yeah, it's super clean. Super clean.
Great. Well, good luck with your bees this winter,
Great.
Sue.
Thank you so much for your suggestions.
And Dennis, welcome to the show.
Hi. It's an interesting subject. I'm not a producer. I'm a consumer. Honey, I'm aficionado, I call myself. I like to buy different blossom honeys when I'm traveling in the lower 48. I've had pumpkin blossom honey and avocado honey and blackberry blossom honey. And the question I had was in Washington, with all the apple trees, I've never been able to find any apple blossom honey. Does anybody know the answer to that?
Well, Mark, you mentioned
I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Dennis.
Thanks.
Mark, you mentioned about pollinating apple trees around you. Do you know any apple blossom honey?
The reason that you don't generally find apple blossom honey is because the bees, apple blossoms happen in the spring, and the bees aren't built up to the point where they're normally storing excess honey. Apparently, Fryer, who was with the Department of Agriculture years ago and did gobs of experiments and studies, I think in Wisconsin, was able to build up colonies strong enough to produce apple blossom honey. But it was, you know, it was an oddity, and nobody really thought that the trees would produce it because bees normally aren't built up that big that early.
Oh, well, okay, well, understanding that aspect of it, you can't get certain things like apple blossom honey, but you do get, as this gentleman just mentioned, also like an avocado honey, which I've never had, but blackberry honey. Are there very distinct differences between some of these honeys? I mean, I know there is with the fireweed, but it seems like a lot of honeys all have like a very similar flavor.
Well, if you took and had a little sample of each honey that you just mentioned, you would be able to sit there and say, "Oh, that's blackberry. Oh, okay." And you would. It may not taste like blackberries, like Mark was saying, but it has a distinctive flavor to it. And I got the opportunity to do that this spring. The beekeeper that I get my packages from had about four different types of honey. One of them was blackberry, and then he had strawberry or raspberry, and a few others that were, it was pretty neat to taste the different ones, but to say they tasted like blackberry or what have you, I really couldn't say that, but it did have different flavors.
And the stuff that we usually buy in the grocery store with the little bare plastic bottle, what kind of honey is that generally then?
Well, that's, I just call it store-bought honey. It's processed honey that, you know, it's, the moisture content is right up there at the legal limit, about 21%. The honey you get here in Alaska or beekeeper honey from local markets is usually around 15 to 17% moisture, so it's sweeter. It takes less to equate to that sweetness. And what is it? They pasteurize the store-bought honey. Is that what it is, Mark?
Well, usually they heat it so that it won't granulate.
Yeah, they heat it up. So
but it's a blend, yeah. What the deal is.
And it's a blend also, yeah. They're bringing stuff in from, I think China, I just heard, is bringing, had an embargo on their honey coming into the United States, so they're selling it through India and Indonesia, which in those two countries and places are selling to the United States 50% more honey than they're able to produce. So where's it coming from? And it's coming in through China, which is, into the U.S. stores. So that you're getting Chinese honey through a world market now. And it's just plain and simple. It's not going to be as good as Mark and I's honey if you can get our honey.
Well, I'll definitely be keeping my eyes out for your honey. I just want to jump back a little bit because it is about honey and keeping healthy bees. But the Veromite, I know that there's different ways to deal with the Veromite. When it first came up, people were freaking out all over the country, this crazy vampire mite sucking the life out of bees. But it looks like we're starting to find ways to contend with these mites. Fletcher Miller was a lifelong beekeeper here in Alaska, at least since 1978. He passed away in 2002, but he left behind tomes of recorded information that I found over at the Fletcher Miller Papers Collection at the Consortium Libraries Archives and Special Collections Department. And he had some fantastic and truly fascinating articles that he had compiled. And one of them was a study done by the USDA where they found one of the most promising ways to get rid of the Veromite was burning off using smoke, particularly the smoke of creosote bush and dried grapefruit leaves. Have you tried either of those, Mark?
I tried using cedar in my smoker for a while because it was supposed to do that. I don't think it's very widely used and accepted, and I'm assuming that that's because it isn't working good enough.
Mm-hmm. What process do you use now, then?
What I use is I divide colonies up to make nukes in the fall, or actually in the end of July. And so if I split a colony up to make four or five colonies out of it, now it's got, each one of those has got 25% of the mites that the original one did. And during that first buildup phase, the percentage of mites per bee doesn't change like it does later after the colony stabilizes in population. And so I do that, and then I also cut out some drone brood, but not all of it. And the Varroa mites prefer the drone brood because the pupa stage is longer and they can reproduce better in the drone brood. And so when I cut some of the drone brood out, I remove physically a higher percentage of mites.
And Mike, do you have another way of dealing with them? Or?
Yeah, in the spring I dust with powdered sugar. I have a bellows type duster. It has a little reservoir on the side that sucks the powdered sugar in the bellows and then sprays it up into the hive, and just to knock them down. And then I also have a brood frame, a drone frame, we call them. I make a drone frame, and the workers build up drone cells, which are a little bit larger than the regular cells that the other bees are made in. And I take that out after they cap it all over because of the pupa stage, with the Varroa mites crawl in there. I take that out, that whole frame out, and put it in the freezer at the house for 24 hours, and then let it thaw out in the garage or outside. And then that way of controlling the drones also, but no, I don't take all the drones, but I control them because that's where the Varroa mite typically lays its eggs.
Again, this is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing beekeeping here in Alaska, how to make good honey, how to keep our bees alive. If you're a beekeeper and have some input, or if you're just wanting to know a little bit more about bees, I encourage you to call us up at 550-8433. 550-8433 or give us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org. We have an email here from Shannon Fitzgerald here in Anchorage. She says, great show. Thank you. I'm new to Alaska, took a beekeeper course in North Carolina, and I'm wondering, one, what kind of bees are best in Alaska? Italian, Russian, and what would your guests say is the best source to get bees? Mike, what would you say about best source?
Well, I'm a pretty good source for getting bees, so you can call me at my phone number, which is on my website, alaskabeeproducts.net, and would have to do it next year, in the, around January. The earlier, the better. We'll take an order. And there's several different strains. It's I provide a choice between two, the Italians and the Carniolas, whatever people want. I'll get them. Some people prefer Russians, and they have all different other types of queens, Buckfest queens that they swear by. But I just provide two with my packages, the Carniolas and the Italians. So either one's fine with me.
Yeah, Mark, did you have any input on that?
Well, supposedly the Russians are going to be a little bit more resistant to the mites, and their wintering scenario should be similar to ours. If you're going to winter, that would be a factor. And then, what I've been using is some queens produced by Purvis Brothers, but it looks like they're kind of going out of that business, so that might not be available in the future.
And she also asked, how might I convince my fiancé, who doesn't care for bees, that we have enough space here in Anchorage, yard probably bigger than 60 foot by 60 feet? I'm working on the meat angle. Any other suggestions? Mark, would you have any?
You might not be able to convince somebody that has already decided on something.
Yeah, it's kind of, I know there's some other people that I know that the lady of the house likes bees or wants to get into beekeeping, and the gentleman says no way, and then you find there's bees in the backyard. And then you just got to educate yourself or educate the other person about the bees. They're not going to come out and run right towards you and sting you every time you come out into the yard. They're interested in getting nectar and providing for the brood, and it can be a fascinating hobby. Take some mead and go sit out by the hive and watch them come and go while you're drinking your mead. That'd be a pretty good deal, huh? I like doing that.
Welcome to the show, Norman. How are you this afternoon?
I'm good.
And what would you like to share with us?
Hey, I have a question about caging your queen. I have three hives myself, one in Girdwood, Portage, and Indian. And I'm doing a class, and over the years I've always caged my queen so I can get the most production of honey so she doesn't lay any more eggs and then spend my honey towards the end of July. What is your things on caging the queen, yes or no, on that?
Yeah, if you're going after honey, it's a common practice to cage the queen about the first week in July. I take it you're not wintering the bees over.
No, I'm not. And I've tried that before, like you said earlier. By the time I got done in May, I have a few hundred bees.
Yeah, it's not, sometimes it's not worth it. I'd cage her in the first part of July, first week. And if you're exterminating the bees at the end of it and you're getting all the honey, then there's no need for her to be laying eggs and consuming the honey if they get a period of time like we do, and especially down there where you are, Girdwood, Portage, and Indian, where you can get three days of rain, no problem, and the bees are in the hive and they eat up all your honey. And you're just going to have extra bees in there feeding the larva, feeding the babies, so, and eating honey, so you can really have it all disappear real quick.
Well, another interesting thing you guys were talking about was the fireweed honey. I have actually taken my bees to fireweed areas, late in the year in August, and strictly have the bees hit the fireweed. And it's definitely has a different taste than the wildflower that we get, and it's a totally clearer honey. Is that the same for you, too?
Yes. Yes, same. Same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people are like, whoa, this is fireweed honey. How can people call their honey that they sell 25% fireweed honey? How do they know that? If they set it next to clover and fireweed, they're going to hit the clover first.
I have no idea. Maybe they're just guessing.
Or if they're mixing it, maybe.
Yeah. It's kind of a lie, I think, when they sell the honey at the fairs. So, well, hey, I mean, really, a friend just called me about this. Hey, you got to turn on the bee thing. So I'm like, I'm glad you guys are talking about this.
Great. Thanks for your call, Norman.
Thanks for your help. Bye-bye.
Hi, Monty. How are you doing this afternoon?
Okay. Great program. A lot of good information.
Good.
I wanted to talk about, my husband is down to one colony, but he overwintered in the upstairs of the garage this year, and pretty much sealed it up, not quite, and then ran a clear plastic tube. You know, you go to the hardware store and you can get all these different kinds of tubes, like aquarium tubes. Well, this is a big, thick one. And then he ran the tube from the hive to outside, and they go back and forth, and they're still up there right now and running back and forth. It's not a real, not a real good situation when it's time to open the hive, that sort of thing. It's kind of awkward because, you know, you can't really get away from them or work very well, but it did keep them going, and that's how he did it.
Do you have a comment for that?
I would really like to see him get out of there. If you could take him out in the spring, you know, when everybody's getting their packages and there's no snow on the ground, if you can get what remains out of the attic of the garage. If you had to land in a tube and walk to all the nectar all the way up to the hive, that'd be quite a march, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it's maybe a couple feet. They're doing it. He did. Of course, he fed over the winter, and I don't know. They're making it. I haven't talked with him about it. I don't know the last time he opened them up to look at them, but they seem to be surprisingly strong. This was first try at it, and before he's kept them outdoors and had insulation, and it was too much insulation, not enough ventilation, and the mold got him.
Well,
that was a bad one.
That garage thing sounds like good old American ingenuity.
That sounds like a European honey house.
It does, doesn't it? The best of all worlds, but like there was somebody said they had bear problems. They wouldn't get them up there.
Well, I couldn't do it in my attic in my garage. It's just too confining. I mean, but sounds like one way to go.
Yeah, there's enough heat loss that it keeps them just a little warmer than being outdoors.
Wow.
Anyway, and I like your suggestion. I think that's a good one of bringing them down and out and putting them in their usual spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be good. And I've got a note here. I've picked up all kinds of things. So thanks so much for the program and all the information you shared.
Great. Thank you so much for your call, Monty. Well, another hour has just whizzed right by. Thank you all for joining me and my guests here today. Next week on Hometown Alaska, host Kathleen McCoy will be discussing summer readings. Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Speck engineered today's program with assistance from Josh Edge. Special thanks to Chris Nelson for his research assistance. And thanks for listening. I'm Tika Ballas, and this has been Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.